Toward income of... Baby's curiosity was such that Dick brought her into the conversation.
In your experience, baby, he demanded, have you found that when a European wants to see an American very pressingly, it is invariably something concerned with money?
What is it? She said innocently.
This young Privat Dozent thinks that he and I ought to launch into big business and try to attract nervous breakdowns from America.
Worried, Franz stared at Baby as Dick continued. But who are we, Franz? You bear a big name, and I've written 2 textbooks. Is that enough to attract anybody? And I haven't got that much money. I haven't got a tenth of it.
Franz smiled cynically. Honestly, I haven't. Nicole and Baby are rich as Croesus, but I haven't managed to get my hands on any of it yet.
They were all listening now. Dick wondered if the girl at the table behind was listening, too. The idea attracted him. He decided to let Baby speak for him, as one often lets women raise their voices over issues that are not in their hands. Baby became suddenly her grandfather, cool and experimental.
I think it's a suggestion you ought to consider, Dick. I don't know what Dr. Gregory was saying, but it seems to me...
Behind him, the girl had leaned forward into a smoke ring and was picking up something from the floor. Nicole's face fitted into his own across the table. Her beauty, tentatively nesting and posing, flowed into his love, ever braced to protect it.
Consider it, Dick, Franz urged excitedly. When one writes on psychiatry, one should have actual clinical contacts. Jung writes. Bleuler writes. Freud writes. Forel writes. Adler writes. Also, they are in constant contact with mental disorder.
Dick has me,
laughed Nicole.
I should think that'd be enough mental disorder for one man.
That's different, said Franz cautiously.
Baby was thinking that if Nicole lived beside a clinic, she would always feel quite safe about her.
We must think it over carefully, she said.
Though amused at her insolence, Dick did not encourage it.
The decision concerns me, Baby, he said gently. It's nice of you to want to buy me a clinic.
Realizing she had meddled, Baby withdrew hurriedly.
Of course, it's entirely your affair.
A thing as important as this will take weeks to decide. I wonder how I like the picture of Nicole and me anchored to Zurich.
He turned to Franz, anticipating...
I know. Zurich has a gas house and running water and electric light. I lived there 3 years. I will leave you to think it over, said Franz. I am confident.
100 pair of 5-pound boots had begun to clump toward the door, and they joined the press. Outside in the crisp moonlight, Dick saw the girl tying her sled to one of the sleighs ahead. They piled into their own sleigh, and at the crisp, cracking whips, the horses strained, breasting the dark air. Past them, figures ran and scrambled, the younger ones shoving each other from sleds and runners, landing in the soft snow, then panting after the horses to drop exhausted on a sled or wail that they were abandoned. On either side, the fields were beneficently tranquil. The space through which the cavalcade moved was high and limitless. In the country, there was less noise as though they were all listening atavistically for wolves in the wide snow. In Zainin, they poured into the municipal dance, crowded with cow herders, hotel servants, shopkeepers, ski teachers, guides, tourists, peasants. To come into the warm, enclosed place after the pantheistic animal feeling without was to reassume some absurd and impressive knightly name. As thunderous as spurred boots in war, as football cleats on the cement of a locker room floor. There was conventional yodeling, and the familiar rhythm of it separated Dick from what he had first found romantic in the scene. At first, he thought it was because he had hounded the girl out of his consciousness. Then it came to him under the form of what Baby had said.
We must think it over carefully.
And the unsaid lines back of that.
We own you. And you'll admit it sooner or later. It is absurd to keep up the pretense of independence.
It had been years since Dick had bottled up malice against a creature. Since freshman year at New Haven, when he had come upon a popular essay about mental hygiene. Now he lost his temper at Baby, and simultaneously tried to coop it up within him, resenting her cold, rich insolence. It would be hundreds of years before any emergent Amazons would ever grasp the fact that a man is vulnerable only in his pride, but delicate as Humpty Dumpty once that is meddled with, though some of them paid the fact a cautious lip service. Dr. Diver's profession of sorting the broken shells of another sort of egg had given him a dread of breakage. But there's too much good manners, he said on the way back to Gstaad in the smooth sleigh.
Well, I think that's nice, said Baby.
No, it isn't, he insisted to the anonymous bundle of fur. Good manners are an admission that everybody is so tender that they have to be handled with gloves. Now, human respect, you don't call a man a coward or a liar lightly, but if you spend your life sparing people's feelings and feeding their vanity, you get so you can't distinguish what should be respected in them.
I think Americans take their manners rather seriously, said the elder Englishman.
I guess so, said Dick. My father had the kind of manners he inherited from the days when he shot first and apologized afterward. Men armed. Why, you Europeans haven't carried arms in civil life since the beginning of the 18th century.
Not actually, perhaps.
Not actually. Not really.
Dick, you've always had such beautiful manners, said Baby, conciliatingly.
The women were regarding him across the zoo of robes with some alarm. The younger Englishman did not understand. He was one of the kind who were always jumping around cornices and balconies, as if they thought they were in the rigging of a ship, and filled the ride to the hotel with a preposterous story about a boxing match with his best friend in which they loved and bruised each other for an hour, always with great reserve. Dick became facetious.
So every time he hit you, you considered him an even better friend?
I respected him more.
It's the premise I don't understand. You and your best friend scrap about a trivial matter.
If you don't understand, I can't explain it to you, said the young Englishman coldly. This is what I'll get if I begin saying what I think, Dick said to himself. He was ashamed at baiting the man, realizing that the absurdity of the story rested in the immaturity of the attitude combined with the sophisticated method of its narration. The carnival spirit was strong, and they went with the crowd into the grill, where a Tunisian barman manipulated the illumination in a counterpoint, whose other melody was the moon off the ice rink staring in the big windows. In that light, Dick found the girl devitalized and uninteresting. He turned from her to enjoy the darkness, the cigarette points going green and silver when the light shone red, the band of white that fell across the dancers as the door to the bar was opened and closed.
Now tell me, Franz, he demanded. Do you think after sitting up all night drinking beer, you can go back and convince your patients that you have any character? Don't you think they'll see you're a gastropath?
I'm going to bed, Nicole announced. Dick accompanied her to the door of the elevator.
I'd come with you, but I must show Franz that I'm not intended for a clinician.
Nicole walked into the elevator. Baby has lots of common sense, she said meditatively.
Baby is one of...
The door slashed shut. Facing a mechanical hum, Dick finished the sentence in his mind.
Baby is a trivial, selfish woman.
But 2 days later, sleighing to the station with Franz, Dick admitted that he thought favorably upon the matter.
We're beginning to turn in a circle, he admitted. Living on this scale, there's an unavoidable series of strains, and Nicole doesn't survive them. The pastoral quality down on the Summer Riviera is all changing anyhow. Next year they'll have a season.
They passed the crisp green rinks where Wiener waltzes blared and the colors of many mountain schools flashed against the pale blue skies.
I hope we'll be able to do it, Franz. There's nobody I'd rather try it with than you.
Goodbye, Gstaad,
Goodbye, fresh faces, cold, sweet flowers, flakes in the darkness. Goodbye, Gstaad. Goodbye.
Chapter 14. Dick awoke at 5 after a long dream of war, walked to the window and stared out it at the Zugersee. His dream had begun in somber majesty. Navy blue uniforms crossed a dark plaza behind bands playing the second movement of Prokofiev's Love of Three Oranges. Presently there were fire engines, symbols of disaster, and a ghastly uprising of the mutilated in a dressing station. He turned on his bed lamp light and made a thorough note of it, ending with the half-ironic phrase, "Non-combatants shell shock." As he sat on the side of his bed, he felt the room, the house, and the night as empty. In the next room, Nicole muttered something desolate, and he felt sorry for whatever loneliness she was feeling in her sleep. For him, time stood still, and then every few years accelerated in a rush, like the quick rewind of a film. But for Nicole, the years slipped away by clock and calendar and birthday, with the added poignance of her perishable beauty. Even this past year and a half on the Zugersee seemed wasted time for her, the seasons marked only by the workmen on the road turning pink in May, brown in July, black in September, white again in spring. She had come out of her first illness alive with new hopes, expecting so much, yet deprived of any subsistence except Dick, bringing up children she could only pretend gently to love, guided orphans. The people she liked, rebels mostly, disturbed her and were bad for her. She sought in them the vitality that had made them independent or creative or rugged. Sought in vain, for their secrets were buried deep in childhood struggles they had forgotten. They were more interested in Nicole's exterior harmony and charm, the other face of her illness. She led a lonely life owning Dick, who did not want to be owned. Many times he had tried unsuccessfully to let go his hold on her. They had many fine times together, fine talks between the loves of the White Knights, but always when he turned away from her into himself, he left her holding nothing in her hands and staring at it, calling it many names, but knowing it was only the hope that he would come back soon. He scrunched his pillow hard, lay down, and put the back of his neck against it as a Japanese does to slow the circulation, and slept again for a time. Later, while he shaved, Nicole awoke and marched around, giving abrupt, succinct orders to children and servants. Lanier came in to watch his father shave. Living beside a psychiatric clinic, he had developed an extraordinary confidence in and admiration for his father, together with an exaggerated indifference toward most other adults. The patients appeared to him either in their odd aspects or else as devitalized, over-correct creatures without personality. He was a handsome, promising boy, and Dick devoted much time to him, in the relationship of a sympathetic but exacting officer and respectful enlisted man.
"Why," Lanier asked, "do you always leave a little lather on the top of your hair when you shave?"
Cautiously, Dick parted soapy lips.
"I have never been able to find out. I've often wondered. I think it's because I get the first finger soapy when I make the line of my sideburn. But how it gets up on top of my head, I don't know."
"I'm going to watch it all tomorrow."
"That's your only question before breakfast?"
"I don't really call it a question."
"That's one on you."
Half an hour later, Dick started up to the administration building. He was 38. Still declining a beard, he yet had a more medical aura about him than he had worn upon the Riviera. For 18 months now, he had lived at the clinic, certainly one of the best appointed in Europe. Like Domler's, it was of the modern type, no longer a single dark and sinister building, but a small, scattered, yet deceitfully integrated village. Dick and Nicole had added much in the domain of taste, so that the plant was a thing of beauty, visited by every psychologist passing through Zurich. With the addition of a catty house, it might very well have been a country club. The Eglantine and the Beeches, houses for those sunk into eternal darkness, were screened by little copses from the main building, camouflaged strong points. Behind was a large truck farm, worked partly by the patients. The workshops for ergotherapy were three, placed under a single roof, and there Dr. Diver began his morning's inspection. The carpentry shop, full of sunlight, exuded the sweetness of sawdust, of a lost age of wood. Always half a dozen men were there, hammering, planing, buzzing. Silent men who lifted solemn eyes from their work as he passed through. Himself a good carpenter, he discussed with them the efficiency of some tools for a moment in a quiet, personal, interested voice. Adjoining was the bookbindery, adapted to the most mobile of patients who were not always, however, those who had the greatest chance for recovery. The last chamber was devoted to beadwork, weaving, and work in brass. The faces of the patients here wore the expression of one who had just sighed profoundly, dismissing something insoluble. But their sighs only marked the beginning of another ceaseless round of ratiocination. Not in a line, as with normal people, but in the same circle. Round, round, and round. Around forever. But the bright colors of the stuffs they worked with gave strangers a momentary illusion that all was well, as in a kindergarten. These patients brightened as Dr. Diver came in. Most of them liked him better than they liked Dr. Gregorovius. Those who had once lived in the great world invariably liked him better. There were a few who thought he neglected them, or that he was not simple, or that he posed. Their responses were not dissimilar to those that Dick evoked in non-professional life. But here, they were warped and distorted. One Englishwoman spoke to him always about a subject which she considered her own. "Have we got music tonight?" "I don't know," he answered. "I haven't seen Dr. Ladislaw. How did you enjoy the music that Mrs. Sachs and Mr. Longstreet gave us last night?"
"It was so-so."
"I thought it was fine, especially the Chopin."
"I thought it was so-so."
"When are you going to play for us yourself?" She shrugged her shoulders, as pleased at this question as she had been for several years.
"Sometime, but I only play so-so."
They knew that she did not play at all. She had had two sisters who were brilliant musicians, but she had never been able to learn the notes when they had been young together. From the workshop, Dick went to visit the Eglantine and the Beeches. Exteriorly, these houses were as cheerful as the others. Nicole had designed the decoration and the furniture on a necessary base of concealed grills and bars and immovable furniture. She had worked with so much imagination, the inventive quality which she lacked being supplied by the problem itself, that no instructed visitor would have dreamed that the light, graceful filigree work at a window was a strong, unyielding end of a tether, that the pieces reflecting modern tubular tendencies were stauncher than the massive creations of the Edwardians. Even the flowers lay in iron fingers, and every casual ornament and fixture was as necessary as a girder in a skyscraper. Her tireless eyes had made each room yield up its greatest usefulness. Complimented, she referred to herself brusquely as a master plumber. For those whose compasses were not depolarized, there seemed many odd things in these houses. Dr. Diver was often amused in the Eglantine, the men's building. Here there was a strange little exhibitionist who thought that if he could walk unclothed and unmolested from the Étoile to the Place de la Concorde, he would solve many things. And, perhaps, Dick thought, he was quite right. His most interesting case was in the main building. The patient was a woman of 30 who had been in the clinic 6 months. She was an American painter who had lived long in Paris. They had no very satisfactory history of her. A cousin had happened upon her all mad and gone, and after an unsatisfactory interlude at one of the whoopee cures that fringed the city, dedicated largely to tourist victims of drug and drink, he had managed to get her to Switzerland. On her admittance, she had been exceptionally pretty. Now she was a living, agonizing sore. All blood tests had failed to give a positive reaction, and the trouble was unsatisfactorily catalogued as nervous eczema. For 2 months she had lain under it, as imprisoned as in the Iron Maiden. She was coherent, even brilliant, within the limits of her special hallucinations. She was particularly his patient. During spells of overexcitement, he was the only doctor who could do anything with her. Several weeks ago, on one of many nights that she had passed in sleepless torture, Franz had succeeded in hypnotizing her into a few hours of needed rest. But he had never again succeeded. Hypnosis was a tool that Dick had distrusted and seldom used, for he knew that he could not always summon up the mood in himself. He had once tried it on Nicole, and she had scornfully laughed at him. The woman in room 20 could not see him when he came in. The area about her eyes was too tightly swollen. She spoke in a strong, rich, deep, thrilling voice.
"How long will this last? Is it going to be forever?"
"It's not going to be very long now. Dr. Ladislaw tells me there are whole areas cleared up.
If I knew what I had done to deserve this, I could accept it with equanimity.
It isn't wise to be mystical about it. We recognize it as a nervous phenomenon. It's related to the blush. When you were a girl, did you blush easily?"
She lay with her face turned to the ceiling.
"I have found nothing to blush for since I cut my wisdom teeth."
"Haven't you committed your share of petty sins and mistakes?"
"I have nothing to reproach myself with."
"You're very fortunate." The woman thought a moment.
Her voice came up through her bandaged face, afflicted with subterranean melodies.
"I'm sharing the fate of the women of my time who challenged men to battle.
To your vast surprise, it was just like all battles," he answered, adopting her formal diction.
"Just like all battles." She thought this over. "You pick a setup, or else win a Pyrrhic victory, or you're wrecked and ruined. You're a ghostly echo from a broken wall."
"You are neither wrecked nor ruined," he told her. "Are you quite sure you've been in a real battle?"
"Look at me,"
she cried furiously. "You've suffered, but many women suffered before they mistook themselves for men." It was becoming an argument, and he retreated. "In any case, you mustn't confuse a single failure with a final defeat." She sneered. "Beautiful words." And the phrase transpiring up through the crust of pain humbled him. "We would like to go into the true reasons that brought you here," he began, but she interrupted.
"I am here as a symbol of something. I thought perhaps you would know what it was."
"You are sick," he said mechanically.
"Then what was it I had almost found?"
"A greater sickness."
"That's all?"
"That's all." With disgust, he heard himself lying. But here and now, the vastness of the subject could only be compressed into a lie.
"Outside of that, there's only confusion and chaos." "I won't lecture to you. We have too acute a realization of your physical suffering. But it's only by meeting the problems of every day, no matter how trifling and boring they seem, that you can make things drop back into place again. After that, perhaps you'll be able again to examine..."
He had slowed up to avoid the inevitable end of his thought. "The frontiers of consciousness. The frontiers that artists must explore were not for her. Ever. She was fine-spun, inbred. Eventually she might find rest in some quiet mysticism. Exploration was for those with a measure of peasant blood, those with big thighs and thick ankles, who could take punishment as they took bread and salt on every inch of flesh and spirit. "Not for you," he almost said. "It's too tough a game for you." Yet in the awful majesty of her pain, he went out to her unreservedly, almost sexually. He wanted to gather her up in his arms, as he so often had Nicole, and cherish even her mistakes. So deeply were they part of her. The orange light through the drawn blind,
the sarcophagus of her figure on the bed, the spot of face, the voice searching the vacuity of her illness and finding only remote abstractions. As he arose, the tears fled lava-like into her bandages.
"That is for something," she whispered. "Something must come out of it."
He stooped and kissed her forehead.
"We must all try to be good," he said.
Leaving her room, he sent the nurse in to her. There were other patients to see. An American girl of 15 who had been brought up on the basis that childhood was intended to be all fun. His visit was provoked by the fact that she had just hacked off all her hair with a nail scissors. There was nothing much to be done for her. A family history of neurosis and nothing stable in her past to build on. The father, normal and conscientious himself, had tried to protect a nervous brood from life's troubles, and had succeeded merely in preventing them from developing powers of adjustment to life's inevitable surprises. There was little that Dick could say.
"Helen, when you're in doubt, you must ask a nurse. You must learn to take advice. Promise me you will."
What was a promise with the head sick? He looked in upon a frail exile from the Caucasus, buckled securely in a sort of hammock, which in turn was submerged in a warm medical bath, and upon the three daughters of a Portuguese general who slid almost imperceptibly toward paresis. He went into the room next to them and told a collapsed psychiatrist that he was better, always better, and the man tried to read his face for conviction, since he hung on the real world only through such reassurance as he could find in the resonance, or lack of it, in Dr. Diver's voice. After that, Dick discharged a shiftless orderly, and by then, it was the lunch hour. Chapter 15. Meals with the patients were a chore he approached with apathy. The gathering, which of course did not include residents at the Eglantine or the beaches, was conventional enough at first sight, but over it brooded always a heavy melancholy. Such doctors as were present kept up a conversation, but most of the patients, as if exhausted by their morning's endeavor, or depressed by the company, spoke little, and ate looking into their plates. Luncheon over, Dick returned to his villa. Nicole was in the salon wearing a strange expression. "Read that," she said. He opened the letter. It was from a woman recently discharged, though with skepticism on the part of the faculty. It accused him in no uncertain terms of having seduced her daughter, who had been at her mother's side during the crucial stage of the illness. It presumed that Mrs. Diver would be glad to have this information and learn what her husband was really like. Dick read the letter again. Couched in clear and concise English, he yet recognized it as the letter of a maniac. Upon a single occasion, he had let the girl, a flirtatious little brunette, ride into Zurich with him, upon her request, and in the evening had brought her back to the clinic. In an idle, almost indulgent way, he kissed her. Later, she tried to carry the affair further, but he was not interested. And subsequently, probably consequently, the girl had come to dislike him and taken her mother away. "This letter is deranged," he said. "I had no relations of any kind with that girl. I didn't even like her."
"Yes, I've tried thinking that," said Nicole.
"Surely you don't believe it."
"I've been sitting here."
He sank his voice to a reproachful note and sat beside her. "This is absurd. This is a letter from a mental patient."
"I was a mental patient."
He stood up and spoke more authoritatively. "Suppose we don't have any nonsense, Nicole. Go and round up the children and we'll start."
In the car, with Dick driving, they followed the little promontories of the lake, catching the burn of light and water in the windshield, tunneling through cascades of evergreen. It was Dick's car. A Renault so dwarfish that they all stuck out of it except the children, between whom Mademoiselle towered mast-like in the rear seat. They knew every kilometer of the road, where they would smell the pine needles and the black stove smoke. A high sun with a face traced on it beat fierce on the straw hats of the children. Nicole
was silent. Dick was uneasy at her straight, hard gaze. Often he felt lonely with her, and frequently she tired him with the short floods of personal revelations that she reserved exclusively for him.
I'm like this. I'm more like that.
But this afternoon he would have been glad had she rattled on in staccato for a while and given him glimpses of her thoughts. The situation was always most threatening when she backed up into herself and closed the doors behind her.
Etzuk, Mademoiselle got out and left them. The divers approached the Agiri Fair through a menagerie of mammoth steamrollers that made way for them. Dick parked the car, and as Nicole looked at him without moving, he said, "Come on, Darl."
Her lips drew apart into a sudden, awful smile, and his belly quailed. But as if he hadn't seen it, he repeated, "Come on, so the children can get out."
"Oh, I'll come all right,"
she answered, tearing the words from some story, spinning itself out inside her, too fast for him to grasp.
"Don't worry about that.
I'll come, then come." She turned from him as he walked beside her, but the smile still flickered across her face, derisive and remote. Only when Lanier spoke to her several times did she manage to fix her attention upon an object, a Punch and Judy show, and to orient herself by anchoring to it. Dick tried to think what to do. The dualism in his views of her, that of the husband, that of the psychiatrist, was increasingly paralyzing his faculties. In these 6 years, she had several times carried him over the line with her, disarming him by exciting emotional pity or by a flow of wit, fantastic and disassociated. So that only after the episode did he realize with the consciousness of his own relaxation from tension that she had succeeded in getting a point against his better judgment. A discussion with Topsy about the guignol, as to whether the punch was the same punch they had seen last year in Cannes. Having been settled, the family walked along again between the booths under the open sky. The women's bonnets perching over velvet vests, the bright spreading skirts of many cantons seemed demure against the blue and orange paint of the wagons and displays. There was the sound of a whining, tinkling hoochie-coochie show. Nicole began to run, very suddenly, so suddenly that for a moment Dick did not miss her. Far ahead he saw her yellow dress twisting through the crowd, an ochre stitch along the edge of reality and unreality, and started after her. Secretly she ran, and secretly he followed. As the hot afternoon went shrill and terrible with her flight, he had forgotten the children. Then he wheeled and ran back to them, drawing them this way and that by their arms, his eyes jumping from booth to booth. "Madame," he cried to a young woman behind a white lottery wheel.
"Est-ce que je peux laisser ces petits avec vous 2 minutes? C'est très urgent. Je vous donnerai 10 francs.
"Mais oui."
He headed the children into the booth.
"Alors, restez avec cette gentille dame."
"Oui, Dick."
He darted off again, but he had lost her. He circled the merry-go-round, keeping up with it till he realized he was running beside it, staring always at the same horse. He elbowed through the crowd and the buvette. Then, remembering a predilection of Nicole's, he snatched up an edge of a fortune-teller's tent and peered within. A droning voice greeted him.
"La septième file d'une septième file née sur les rives du Nil. Entrez, monsieur."
Dropping the flap, he ran along toward where the plaisance terminated at the lake, and a small Ferris wheel revolved slowly against the sky. There he found her. She was alone in what was momentarily the top boat of the wheel. And as it descended, he saw that she was laughing hilariously. He slunk back in the crowd, a crowd which, at the wheel's next revolution, spotted the intensity of Nicole's hysteria.
"Regardez-moi ça! Regarde donc cette Anglaise!"
Down she dropped again. This time the wheel and its music were slowing, and a dozen people were around her car, all of them impelled by the quality of her laughter to smile in sympathetic idiocy. But when Nicole saw Dick, her laughter died. She made a gesture of slipping by and away from him, but he caught her arm and held it as they walked away.
Why did you lose control of yourself like that?
You know very well why.
No, I don't.
That's just preposterous.
Let me loose. That's an insult to my intelligence.
Don't you think I saw that girl look at you? That little dark girl?
Oh, this is farcical. A child. Not more than 15. Don't you think I saw? Stop here a minute and quiet down.
They sat at a table, her eyes in a profundity of suspicion, her hand moving across her line of sight as if it were obstructed.
I want a drink. I want a brandy. You can't have brandy. You can have a bock if you want it.
Why can't I have a brandy?
We won't go into that. Listen to me. This business about a girl is a delusion. Do you understand that word?
It's always a delusion when I see what you don't want me to see.
He had a sense of guilt, as in one of those nightmares where we are accused of a crime which we recognize as something undeniably experienced, but which upon waking, we realize we have not committed. His eyes wavered from hers.
I left the children with a gypsy woman in a booth. We ought to get them.
Who do you think you are?
She demanded. Svengali?
15 minutes ago, they had been a family. Now, as she was crushed into a corner by his unwilling shoulder, he saw them all, child and man, as a perilous accident.
We're going home.
Home!
She roared in a voice so abandoned that its louder tones wavered and cracked.
And sit and think that we're all rotting and the children's ashes are rotting in every box I open? That filth!
Almost with relief, he saw that her words sterilized her, and Nicole, sensitized down to the corium of the skin, saw the withdrawal in his face. Her own face softened, and she begged.
Help me. Help me, Dick.
A wave of agony went over him. It was awful that such a fine tower should not be erected, only suspended. Suspended from him. Up to a point that was right. Men were for that. Beam, an idea, girder, and logarithm. But somehow, Dick and Nicole had become one and equal, not opposite and complementary. She was Dick, too. The drought in the marrow of his bones. He could not watch her disintegrations without participating in them. His intuition rilled out of him as tenderness and compassion. He could only take the characteristically modern course to interpose. He would get a nurse from Zurich to take her over tonight.
You can help me.
Her sweet bullying pulled him forward off his feet.
You've helped me before. You can help me now.
I can only help you the same old way.
Someone can help me.
Maybe so. You can help yourself most. Let's find the children.
There were numerous lottery booths with white wheels. Dick was startled when he inquired at the first and encountered blank disavowals. Evil-eyed, Nicole stood apart, denying the children, resenting them as part of a downright world she sought to make amorphous. Presently, Dick found them, surrounded by women who were examining them with delight like fine goods, and by peasant children staring.
Merci, monsieur. Ah, monsieur, et trop généreux. C'était un plaisir, monsieur, madame. Au revoir, mes petits.
They started back with a hot sorrow streaming down upon them. The car was weighted with their mutual apprehension and anguish, and the children's mouths were grave with disappointment. Grief presented itself in its terrible, dark, unfamiliar color. Somewhere around Zook, Nicole, with a convulsive effort, reiterated a remark she had made before about a misty yellow house set back from the road that looked like a painting not yet dry. But it was just an attempt to catch at a rope that was playing out too swiftly.
Dick tried to rest. The struggle would come presently at home, and he might have to sit a long time, restating the universe for her. A schizophrene is well-named as a split personality. Nicole was alternately a person to whom nothing need be explained, and one to whom nothing could be explained. It was necessary to treat her with active and affirmative insistence, keeping the road to reality always open, making the road to escape harder going. But the brilliance, the versatility of madness is akin to the resourcefulness of water seeping through, over and around a dike. It requires the united front of many people to work against it. He felt it necessary that this time Nicole cure herself. He wanted to wait until she remembered the other times and revolted from them. In a tired way, he planned that they would again resume the regime relaxed a year before. He had turned up a hill that made a shortcut to the clinic. And now, as he stepped on the accelerator for a short straightaway run parallel to the hillside, the car swerved violently left, swerved right, tipped on two wheels, and as Dick, with Nicole's voice screaming in his ear, crushed down the mad hand clutching the steering wheel, righted itself, swerved once more, and shot off the road. It tore through low underbrush, tipped again, and settled slowly at an angle of 90 degrees against a tree. The children were screaming, and Nicole was screaming, and cursing, and trying to tear at Dick's face. Thinking first of the list of the car, and unable to estimate it, Dick bent away Nicole's arm, climbed over the top side, and lifted out the children. Then he saw the car was in a stable position. Before doing anything else, he stood there, shaking and panting.
"You!"
he cried. She was laughing hilariously. Unashamed, unafraid, unconcerned. No one coming on the scene would have imagined that she had caused it. She laughed as after some mild escape of childhood.
"You were scared, weren't you?"
she accused him.
"You wanted to live."
She spoke with such force that in his shocked state, Dick wondered if he had been frightened for himself. But the strained faces of the children, looking from parent to parent, made him want to grind her grinning mask into jelly. Directly above them, half a kilometer by the winding road, but only 100 yards climbing, was an inn. One of its wings showed through the wooded hill. "Take Topsy's hand," he said to Lanier. "Like that. Tight. And climb up that hill. See the little path? When you get to the inn, tell them, 'La voiture d'hiver écossais.' Someone must come right down." Lanier, not sure what had happened, but suspecting the dark and unprecedented, asked, "What will you do, Dick?"
"We'll stay here with the car."
Neither of them looked at their mother as they started off.
"Be careful crossing the road up there. Look both ways,"
Dick shouted after them. He and Nicole looked at each other directly, their eyes like blazing windows across a court of the same house. Then she took out a compact, looked in its mirror, and smoothed back the temple hair. Dick watched the children climbing for a moment until they disappeared among the pines halfway up. Then he walked around the car to see the damage and plan how to get it back on the road. In the dirt, he could trace the rocking course they had pursued for over 100 feet. He was filled with a violent disgust that was not like anger. In a few minutes, the proprietor of the inn came running down.
"My God!" he exclaimed. "How did it happen? Were you going fast? What luck! Except for that tree, you'd have rode downhill."
Taking advantage of Emile's reality, the wide black apron, the sweat upon the rolls of his face, Dick signaled to Nicole in a matter-of-fact way to let him help her from the car, whereupon she jumped over the lower side, lost her balance on the slope, fell to her knees, and got up again. As she watched the men trying to move the car, her expression became defiant. Welcoming even that mood, Dick said, "Go and wait with the children, Nicole." Only after she had gone,
did he remember that she had wanted cognac, and that there was cognac available up there. He told Emil never mind about the car. They would wait for the chauffeur and the big car to pull it up onto the road. Together, they hurried up to the inn. Chapter 16.
I want to go away,
he told Franz.
For a month or so, for as long as I can.
Why not, Dick? That was our original arrangement. It was you who insisted on staying. If you and Nicole...
I don't want to go away with Nicole. I want to go away alone. This last thing knocked me sideways. If I get 2 hours sleep in 24, it's one of Zwingli's miracles.
You wish a real leave of abstinence.
The word is absence.
Look here. If I go to Berlin to the psychiatric congress, could you manage to keep the peace? For 3 months she's been all right, and she likes her nurse.
My God, you're the only human being in this world I can ask this of.
Franz grunted, considering whether or not he could be trusted to think always of his partner's interest. In Zurich the next week, Dick drove to the airport and took the big plane for Munich. Soaring and roaring into the blue, he felt numb, realizing how tired he was. A vast, persuasive quiet stole over him, and he abandoned sickness to the sick, sound to the motors, direction to the pilot. He had no intention of attending so much as a single session of the Congress. He could imagine it well enough. New pamphlets by Bleuler and the elder Forel that he could much better digest at home. The paper by the American who cured dementia praecox by pulling out his patients' teeth or cauterizing their tonsils. The half-derisive respect with which this idea would be greeted, for no more reason than that America was such a rich and powerful country. The other delegates from America, red-headed Schwartz with his saint's face and his infinite patience in straddling two worlds, as well as dozens of commercial alienists with hangdog faces, who would be present partly to increase their standing, and hence their reach for the big plums of the criminal practice, partly to master novel sophistries that they could weave into their stock and trade, to the infinite confusion of all values. There would be cynical Latins and some man of Freud's from Vienna. Articulate among them would be the great Jung, bland, super vigorous, on his rounds between the forests of anthropology and the neuroses of schoolboys. At first there would be an American cast to the Congress, almost Rotarian in its forms and ceremonies. Then the closer-knit European vitality would fight through. And finally, the Americans would play their trump card, the announcement of colossal gifts and endowments, of great new plants and training schools. And in the presence of the figures, the Europeans would blanch and walk timidly. But he would not be there to see. They skirted the Vorarlberg Alps, and Dick felt a pastoral delight in watching the villages. There were always four or five in sight, each one gathered around a church. It was simple, looking at the earth from far off. Simple as playing grim games with dolls and soldiers. This was the way statesmen and commanders and all retired people looked at things. Anyhow, it was a good draft of relief. An Englishman spoke to him from across the aisle, but he found something antipathetic in the English lately. England was like a rich man after a disastrous orgy who makes up to the household by chatting with them individually, when it is obvious to them that he is only trying to get back his self-respect in order to usurp his former power. Dick had with him what magazines were available on the station quays. The Century, the Motion Picture, L'Illustration, and the Fliegende Blätter. But it was more fun to descend in his imagination into the villages and shake hands with the rural characters. He sat in the churches as he sat in his father's church in Buffalo, amid the starchy must of Sunday clothes. He listened to the wisdom of the Near East, was crucified, died, and was buried in the cheerful church, and once more worried between 5 or 10 cents for the collection plate because of the girl who sat in the pew behind.
The Englishman suddenly borrowed his magazines with a little small change of conversation, and Dick, glad to see them go, thought of the voyage ahead of him. Wolf-like under his sheep's clothing of long, staple Australian wool, he considered the world of pleasure, the incorruptible Mediterranean with sweet old dirt caked in the olive trees, the peasant girl near Savona with a face as green and rose as the color of an illuminated missal. He would take her in his hands and snatch her across the border, but there he deserted her. He must press on toward the Isles of Greece, the cloudy waters of unfamiliar ports, the lost girl on shore, the moon of popular songs. A part of Dick's mind was made up of the tawdry souvenirs of his boyhood. Yet in that somewhat littered 5 and 10, he had managed to keep alive the low, painful fire of intelligence. Chapter 17. Tommy Barbon was a ruler. Tommy was a hero. Dick happened upon him in the Marienplatz in Munich, in one of those cafes where small gamblers diced on tapestry mats. The air was full of politics and the slap of cards. Tommy was at a table laughing his martial laugh. As a rule, he drank little. Courage was his game, and his companions were always a little afraid of him. Recently, an eighth of the area of his skull had been removed by a Warsaw surgeon and was knitting under his hair. And the weakest person in the cafe could have killed him with a flip of a knotted napkin. "This is Prince Chilichev," a battered, powder-gray Russian of 50. "And Mr. McKibben, and Mr. Hannon." The latter was a lively ball of black eyes and hair, a clown, and he said immediately to Dick, "The first thing before we shake hands, what do you mean by fooling around with my aunt?" "Why, I..." "You heard me. What are you doing here in Munich anyhow?" "Oh, ha, ha, ha," laughed Tommy. "Haven't you got aunts of your own? Why don't you fool with them?" Dick laughed, whereupon the man shifted his attack. "Now let's not have any more talk about aunts. How do I know you didn't make up the whole thing? Here you are, a complete stranger with an acquaintance of less than half an hour, and you come up to me with a cock and bull story about your aunts. How do I know what you have concealed about you?" Tommy laughed again. Then he said good-naturedly, but firmly, "That's enough, Carly. Sit down, Dick. How are you? How's Nicole?" He did not like any man very much, nor feel their presence with much intensity. He was all relaxed for combat. As a fine athlete, playing secondary defense in any sport is really resting much of the time, while a lesser man only pretends to rest and is at a continual and self-destroying nervous tension. Hannon, not entirely suppressed, moved to an adjoining piano, and with recurring resentment on his face whenever he looked at Dick, played chords from time to time, muttering, "Your aunts," and, in a dying cadence, "I didn't say ants anyhow. I said pants."
"Well, how are you?" repeated Tommy. "You don't look so..."
He fought for a word.
"So jaunty as you used to. So spruce. You know what I mean."
The remark sounded too much like one of those irritating accusations of waning vitality, and Dick was about to retort by commenting on the extraordinary suits worn by Tommy and Prince Chilichev, suits of a cut and pattern fantastic enough to have sauntered down Beale Street on a Sunday, when an explanation was forthcoming.
"I see you are regarding our clothes," said the prince. "We have just come out of Russia."
"These were made in Poland by the court tailor," said Tommy. "That's a fact. Pilsudski's own tailor." "You've been touring?" Dick asked.
They laughed, the prince inordinately meanwhile clapping Tommy on the back.
"Yes, we have been touring. That's it. Touring. We have made the grand tour of all the Russias. In state."
Dick waited for an explanation,
It came from Mr. McKibben in two words.
They escaped.
Have you been prisoners in Russia?
It was I,
explained Prince Chilichev, his dead yellow eyes staring at Dick.
Not a prisoner, but in hiding.
Did you have much trouble getting out?
Some trouble. We left 3 Red Guards dead at the border. Tommy left 2.
He held up 2 fingers like a Frenchman.
I left 1.
That's the part I don't understand, said Mr. McKibben. Why they should have objected to your leaving? Hannon turned from the piano and said, winking at the others,
Mac thinks a Marxian is somebody who went to St. Mark's school.
It was an escape story in the best tradition. An aristocrat hiding 9 years with a former servant and working in a government bakery. The 18-year-old daughter in Paris who knew Tommy Barbon. During the narrative, Dick decided that this parched papier-mâché relic of the past was scarcely worth the lives of 3 young men. The question arose as to whether Tommy and Chilichev had been frightened.
When I was cold, Tommy said, I always get scared when I'm cold. During the war, I was always frightened when I was cold.
McKibben stood up.
I must leave. Tomorrow morning I'm going to Innsbruck by car with my wife and children. And the governess.
I'm going there tomorrow too, said Dick.
How are you?
Exclaimed McKibben.
Why not come with us? It's a big Packard, and there's only my wife and my children and myself. And the governess. I can't possibly... Of course, she's not really a governess,
McKibben concluded, looking rather pathetically at Dick.
As a matter of fact, my wife knows your sister-in-law, Baby Warren.
But Dick was not to be drawn in a blind contract.
I've promised to travel with 2 men.
Oh, McKibben's face fell.
Well, I'll say goodbye.
He unscrewed 2 blooded wire hairs from a nearby table and departed. Dick pictured the jammed Packard pounding toward Innsbruck with the McKibbens and their children and their baggage and yapping dogs and the governess.
The paper says they know the man who killed him, said Tommy. But his cousins did not want it in the papers because it happened in a speakeasy. What do you think of that?
It's what's known as family pride. Hannon played a loud chord on the piano to attract attention to himself.
I don't believe his first stuff holds up, he said. Even barring the Europeans, there are 12 Americans can do what North did.
It was the first indication Dick had had that they were talking about Abe North.
The only difference is that Abe did it first, said Tommy.
I don't agree, persisted Hannon. He got the reputation for being a good musician because he drank so much that his friends had to explain him away somehow.
What's this about Abe North?
What about him? Is he in a jam?
Didn't you read the Herald this morning?
No. He's dead. He was beaten to death in a speakeasy in New York. He just managed to crawl home to the racket club to die, Abe North.
Yes, sure. They...
Abe North?
Dick stood up.
Are you sure he's dead?
Hannon turned around to McKibben.
It wasn't the racket club he crawled to. It was the Harvard Club. I'm sure he didn't belong to the racket.
The paper said so,
McKibben insisted.
It must have been a mistake. I'm quite sure.
Beaten to death in a speakeasy.
But I happen to know most of the members of the racket club,
said Hannon.
It must have been the Harvard Club.
Dick got up. Tommy, too. Prince Chilichev started out of a wan study of nothing. Perhaps of his chances of ever getting out of Russia. A study that had occupied him so long that it was doubtful he could give it up immediately and join them in leaving.
Abe North, beaten to death.
On the way to the hotel, a journey of which Dick was scarcely aware, Tommy said,
We're waiting for a tailor to finish some suits so we can get to Paris. I'm going into stockbroking, and they wouldn't take me if I showed up like this.
Everybody in your country is making millions. Are you really leaving tomorrow? We can't even have dinner with you? It seems the prince had an old girl in Munich. He called her up, but she'd been dead 5 years, and we're having dinner with the two daughters. The prince nodded.
Perhaps I could have arranged...